Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So let's see, we've got an interest rate story on the program today, a little bit of European debt crisis, and also something on alternative reality, which is not those first two things I was talking about. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 19th of June. Good as always to have you here. Well, the last best hope for the American economy meets tomorrow. All right, that's kind of a subjective rendering of the Federal Reserve get-together that starts in the morning. But Mr. Bernanke and company are doubtless feeling a little bit of pressure. The markets have been unsettled of late. Europe is still Europe. Our economy is shaky. Congress can barely agree to disagree, so what is the Fed to do? It's already brought interest rates about as low as possible, and that is still not helping people who really need cheap money right now. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more about life on the wrong side of the credit gap.
Willow Elliott would really like to spend money and boost the American economy. She's got a stable job, makes about $40,000 a year, and pays her bills on time. But this divorced grandmother says her credit union turned her down for an $8,000 car loan. Interest rate, 2.99%.
I was told that I needed to wait one more year before they would look at me as a not being a credit risk.
The black mark on Elliott's record, a condo foreclosure that knocked her stellar FICO score down into the low 600s. It's gone back up since, but not enough, apparently, to satisfy today's nervous lenders. Elliott just hopes her 1992 Toyota Corolla doesn't die on her in the meantime.
I have to keep it, and I don't want to take money out of my 401k, which has been really faltering lately with the market also. I'm kind of worried about that.
No matter what Fed officials decide in Washington tomorrow, it's probably not going to help Willow Elliott buy the used Prius she's after. Banks are still skittish about lending to anyone with any financial hiccups, economist Adolfo Laurenti at Mesirow Financial.
And that has really resulted in this credit gap where the less risky borrower that tend to be the affluent people can still get the money that they probably do not need.
Like a cheaper mortgage, economists say those folks will likely pocket the money they've saved instead of shopping for things like cars, the kind of spending that stimulates a lethargic economy. I'm Sarah Gardner from Marketplace.
Speaking of lethargic economies, not much new in the European debt crisis to report today, so we thought we'd take a minute to get a little bit of context, perspective, if you will, from a person who knows a little something about financial meltdowns. Neel Kashkari ran the TARP at the Treasury Department during the Bush administration, the bank bailout. He is now head of global equities at PIMCO. That's the big investment firm here in Southern California. Neel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
As a guy who was at the center of the financial crisis in this country, do you buy the position that Greece is analogous to Lehman Brothers, and if Greece goes, then the whole shebang just comes crashing down?
I can certainly see those arguments, and I understand them. The truth is, no one knows for sure what's going to happen when Greece ultimately exits. It's a question of
wait. You said when Greece exits. That's what you're thinking?
Yes, we believe that, and I believe that Greece will ultimately choose to exit the Eurozone. You know, the Greek people have a choice. One path is continued austerity. But as I see it, austerity is an unstable path because it requires the democracy to continue to reaffirm that decision. So every month or every 6 months or every year, the Greek people have to say, yes, we're going to sign up for more pain for another year. If they go to the other path, which is exit, it will also be very painful. But once they move to exit, there's no undoing that choice.
How did this become a banking crisis billed as a bank bailout, but really it's a bailout of Spain? How did this happen?
Well, at some level, the sovereign is funding the banks, but then the banks are turning around and buying the sovereign debt, and the money shuffles between the financial system and the real economic system. And so it's very hard to disentangle these two different systems in a modern capitalist economy. It's true in America, too. We had to go in and stabilize our banking system in 2008, not for their own sake, but because if we had allowed them to fail, they would have brought down the U.S. economy. And it was trying to save the economy. That's what motivated us.
Tell me what it's like, actually, now that you bring it up. You were at the Treasury Department in 2008 working for Henry Paulson, the secretary back then. What's it like at the center of a financial storm like this?
You know, I've never served in the military, so forgive me using the analogy, but it felt like we were at war, which was every moment of every day we wanted to survive, keep the system together for one more day. And so when I look at what policymakers in Europe are going through, it's easier for us to criticize them, but I think that they've done a pretty good job keeping the system together in an extraordinarily difficult environment.
While I have you, Jamie Dimon is testifying in Washington again today. What do you make of the relationship between Wall Street and Washington and the effectiveness of the new regulatory framework that we have in this country?
It's very hard to design regulations today that are going to be effective in 10 years, 30 years, or 50 years from now. So I think they're well-intended. I think we don't know yet how effective they're going to be.
Yeah, and as always, it's not a question of if there's another financial crisis, it's when, right?
It is, because if you look at the history of humans, human history is full of financial crises because we are all prone to mass delusions. 50 years from now or 80 years from now, unfortunately, we will have another nationwide delusion, and it will be very hard to prevent.
Neel Kashkari, he was at Goldman Sachs. He was at the Treasury Department during the financial crisis. He is now head of global equities at PIMCO down in Newport Beach. Neel, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
We were talking on the program yesterday about HENRYs. That's high earners, not rich yet. It's an acronym that economists are starting to use. You all, though, took to Twitter and to Facebook to have a little fun with it and offer up some acronyms of your own about your place in the global economy. Here's one of them.
I'm more of a Lisa. Low income, spending addiction. Where's our story?
More coming up as we go along. Send us yours if you got them. Twitter is at MarketplaceAPM, or we've got a Facebook page as well. Not a bad day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consider for just a second how we watch television now. Maybe you, definitely your teenage kids, smartphone in one hand, iPad close by, Facebooking and texting and searching. It's really never been so hard for an entertainment company to get somebody's undivided attention. Rather than fight the device war, though, some companies are embracing that phenomenon. Noah Nelson of Turnstile News brings us the story of one company going all in.
Don't you just hate it when the phone rings in the middle of a good show? But what if it's the show calling?
911, what's the nature of your emergency?
I think my friends were murdered.
Okay, are you with the victims?
Well, yeah, with one of them.
That's how the new web series Dirty Work begins. Your cell phone rings, you answer. And as you eavesdrop on a call between an operator and an eyewitness, crime scene footage unspools on the screen. Then comes a text message from a character who's about to join the story. Later, you might get an email. You get the idea. Dirty Work traces the lives of a crime scene cleanup crew, but their story is only half the story. Dirty Work is the first series to use a new platform known as Rides, and it's designed for viewers who have, well, attention deficit disorder. Here's how it works. You register at rides.tv with your email, or you can sign in through Facebook. Rides does the rest.
It collects all of those things together, right? Your Facebook account, your Twitter account, and your what you're looking at the moment, and your telephone number, and your ability to receive text messages, and on it goes.
That's Alon Lee. He's the chief creative officer of Fourth Wall Studios, where Rides was developed.
And it synchronizes them all together so that they all work in unison to tell a really, really good story.
And suck you in with all of your devices. You'll be so focused interacting with Dirty Work, you won't have time for Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. This is where entertainment is headed, with giants like Microsoft and Sony looking to create more immersive experiences. The founders of Fourth Wall Studios have a lot of practice telling stories this way. They pioneered something known as alternate reality games, ARGs.
They were stories that would reach out to you and live in the same world that you lived in. So all of a sudden, you know, you'd be playing a game and in the middle of the night, a character from the game would call you on your cell phone. And that's how the next chapter would begin.
The problem is the players got so good so fast, designers had trouble making the games complex enough. But a half-hour web show is a whole lot easier to understand. So Fourth Wall created Dirty Work, and last year, the company landed $15 million in backing, enough to bring in experienced film and TV production people, Emmy-winning writers, and recognizable actors from shows like 24 and Breaking Bad. Liz Shannon Miller writes about online video for the tech blog GigaOM.
What's going to be key to them succeeding is to figure out how to monetize it.
The main ways that web series do that are with product placement and advertising or subscription fees. And Miller says Rides has the potential to succeed.
The transmedia platform that Fourth Wall is like developing here encourages a much more engaged viewer. That could be much more interesting to advertisers than, say, throwing a 30-second spot at the beginning of, you know, a YouTube video.
Fourth Wall has produced 3 episodes of Dirty Work for the web so far. There's no word on viewers or ads yet, but they have a stack of shows in development across all kinds of genres. But the big question remains, can anyone survive long-term on the strength of short attention spans? In Los Angeles, I'm Noah Nelson for Marketplace.
Noah is a reporter for TurnstileNews.com. That's a project of Youth Radio. All right, here's another in today's series of listener-generated economic acronyms. There's Yuppie and Dink and this.
I'm a Psy, single, intelligent, hardworking guy. Or is that single, intelligent guy hardworking?
There was a little bit of talk at that House Financial Services Committee hearing today, the one J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon was testifying at, about financial regulations and the Dodd-Frank reform bill. As it happens, one of the best-known parts of that law hit a milestone today. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is out with its first list of complaints about credit card companies. It's not a long list yet, just 137 complaints in the database so far. Still, we sent Marketplace's John Dimsdale off this morning to check it out.
The database out today is pretty sparse. The zip code the complaint came from, the credit card company it's against, and what the resolution is. I looked at the website with Scott Pluta, who's in charge of consumer response at the CFPB.
In this age of data and transparency, I think the natural conclusion is to provide that information to the marketplace. I mean, the more information that a marketplace has, I think the better decisions are made at the consumer level.
So far, it seems to be a little skimpy, but you're saying that there will be more data coming.
So far, it's very skimpy, to use a technical term. This is the beta version, but what you can see over time is there are certain institutions that don't provide timely responses. There are certain institutions that provide higher rates of resolution to complaints than others. So these are some of the things that consumers can look at, and reporters and researchers, and they can draw conclusions from that.
Pluta says third-party data crunchers are already using the CFPB's information to put together models that compare the number and types of complaints among credit card companies. He anticipates there will even be apps for mobile phones. And the Protection Bureau is planning more databases in the future for complaints about mortgages, bank accounts, and student loans. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We did a story last week about healthcare costs, what Medicare pays for a given medical procedure specifically, and a part of the American Medical Association called the Relative Value Update Committee, RUC for short. One person we didn't talk to for that piece, but should have, is the head of that committee, Dr. Barbara Levy.
Only at the very end did it note that a volunteer committee of physicians, known as the RUC, provides at no cost to taxpayers a valuable service no other entity can provide. The RUC does not determine prices. It is extremely disappointing that we were not contacted. I am proud that we incorporate the expertise of more than 300 volunteer physicians and other experts who attend our meetings into recommendations to improve the Medicare program.
Coming up,
I mean, we all know each other, and we all know our tactics, and I think we all know our positions where we're at. And it's a pretty tight community.
Businesses and environmentalists, they're close, but not exactly BFFs. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 95 points on this Tuesday, 0.75%, finished at 12,837 ahead of the Fed meeting tomorrow. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, 1.2%, wrapped up at 29.29. The S&P 500 put on 13 points. I don't know, that just struck me funny, 29.29. Anyway, the S&P 500 up 13 points, nearly 1%, 13.57 at the bell. Bank of America scooped up 4.5% today. Morgan Stanley and Citigroup each pocketed more than 3%. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase gained more than 2%. Wells Fargo up 1.5%. Microsoft rose almost 3% today following yesterday's release of its new Surface tablet. Oracle conjured up a gain of 3% on better-than-expected quarterly earnings. Walgreens shares dropped nearly 6% today. That after the drugstore chain announced plans to buy a chunk of the European retailer Allianz Boots. We'll have more on that one later. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The United Nations observes World Refugee Day. In Washington, a Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs subcommittee examines the initial public offering process. Is it working for ordinary investors? And not a great day for vampires. Tomorrow is the longest day of the year. Summer begins. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The G20 meeting down in Los Cabos, Mexico, leaders of the world's 20 biggest economies, wrapped up today. Those who've been hoping for a definitive plan to end the European debt crisis came away disappointed, as they knew they would. But it does give us another chance to ask,
what's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? Today, Italy, and journalist Sophia Celeste in Milan. Sophia, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So I'll tell you what, I was going to ask you all about the Greek elections and Spanish bond yields, but I imagine really the only thing people are talking about over there is soccer and the Italians beating the Irish, right, yesterday?
That's absolutely true. I was on my way to work this morning, and I heard a group of older women talking about it at a cafe. So I think that's pretty indicative of how exciting Italy's win over Ireland was last night.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Little old ladies in a cafe talking soccer.
It was, and they actually had a lot to say, especially about Mario Balotelli, who is an Italian football player of Ghanaian descent.
Oh.
And it's probably the first time a soccer player of African descent has been regarded as such a soccer hero in Italy.
So did this game give people a lift? Because, I mean, you know, improve the mood at all? Because my guess would be, you know, reading the headlines about what's going on over there would just get depressing.
Exactly. You know, yesterday's win was a little reprieve from all of the economic doldrums.
So what happens next, do you think? This whole debt crisis thing, I mean, where does this all go for the Italians and for the Europeans?
That's a difficult question to answer. You know, my husband's a lawyer and I'm a journalist, and I think we're luckier than most, but it's totally impossible to predict tomorrow. We're all sort of living on edge a little bit these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that get tiring?
It gets tiring. Talking to other people, I think that people are just staying in jobs that they don't really like because there's no certainty that they'll even be able to find another job tomorrow. And young people are so disillusioned that they're not even trying to find jobs.
Sophia Celeste in Milan for us today. Sophia, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
All right, so this one's my favorite listener acronym. It's a little bit sad, but it's pretty good.
Sitcom here, I'm afraid. That's single income, two children, oppressive mortgage. Also suffering stress, still trying to regain employment and stay solvent.
The center of the environmental universe this week is Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. It's the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development, Rio Plus 20 for short, to recognize the first UN Earth Summit held down in Rio 20 years ago. The big change this time is that businesses are going to be there, too. And the working relationship between big companies and big environment has gotten better over the past two decades. They're not exactly best friends, but Marketplace's Eve Tro reports now from the sustainability desk. You could call them frenemies.
In Northern California, redwood country, the Garcia River used to run thick with silvery coho salmon. Today,
they're down to less than 1% of their numbers from the 1950s and 60s. So they're in pretty dire straits.
Jennifer Kara is an ecologist with a nonprofit, the Nature Conservancy. She stomps through the river in waist-high waders, a hat over her blonde ponytail, to show me huge logs laid across the river.
The pieces that have the little orange flag and metal tags on them are pieces that we placed.
The tree trunks create shady pools, perfect for coho salmon to mate.
Fisheries biologists would come out and say this kind of thing is a coho hotel. That's what they like to call them. Ooh, there's a fish by your foot. Do you see it?
Yeah. It's tiny, about 2 inches long. The log hides this baby salmon from hungry birds. Kara works on her project with the very industry that destroyed the salmon's home. Lumberjacks help her harvest and position the thick tree trunks for this coho hotel. Nature Conservancy manager Brian Stranko says the partnership would have been hard to imagine decades ago.
There was a huge fight between folks who cared about conservation and timber folks. Literally, people were chaining themselves to trees to not have trees cut.
Clashing at loggerheads didn't help either side. A few patches of forest got saved, but huge areas were completely cleared. Stranko says now both sides have the same goal, harvesting some trees sustainably.
So that we can have both a thriving economy up here and a healthy environment.
He says corporate funding is more important since the recession, as public research money has dried up. But to find common ground, industry and NGOs have to talk it out. And they do. At a recent meeting in San Francisco, a group called the Future 500 brought together government, business, and environmental groups to tackle recycling for product packaging.
We know how to recycle a whole lot of materials. The question is, who's going to pay for that?
Here in the U.S., taxpayers pay for the recycling of packaging.
Recycling can be not just a cost to business, but also a benefit.
There's a healthy tension in the room. The rules of engagement are that you have to come with a willingness to listen.
That last voice is Michael Washburn, Director of Sustainability for Nestle Bottled Waters. It's his first corporate job after decades working for environmental groups. He was the guy running smear campaigns or filing lawsuits against business.
In the past, you'd see companies and NGOs gathering in their respective spheres and sort of lobbing messages at one another.
Now he works to make Nestle Waters an environmental leader, starting with a goal to recycle half of all its plastic bottles. But Washburn says Nestle shouldn't bear that cost alone.
Soup cans, tuna cans, paper boxes for cereal, other plastic packages for laundry detergent. You have to deal with this issue in a holistic way. It can't just be about beverage containers.
He wants NGOs to put pressure on other types of packaging and for companies to step up, stop making beverage brands take all the heat for their cans and bottles. Jim Hanna is director of environmental impact for Starbucks. He says it's a friendly sparring match.
I mean, we all know each other and we all know our tactics, and I think we all know our positions where we're at. And it's a pretty tight community.
That closeness can be risky. Take Starbucks' relationship with the social justice group Oxfam. A few years ago, Oxfam targeted Starbucks over coffee prices in Ethiopia.
In ways, they deserve to be a little bit more exposed.
Chris Jocknick with Oxfam remembers a full-page newspaper ad he helped write against Starbucks.
They've built their reputation and the value of that brand around certain commitments. It's only right that they're held accountable for those commitments.
Jocknick says it's easier to campaign against companies than to work with them. Partnering consumes resources and time. Plus, it can alienate donors.
Oxfam also has to be considerate of our own brand.
But joining forces can lead to more progress, faster. Oxfam has a new program enlisting companies to lobby for action on climate change. Starbucks has signed on. The company's environmental director, Jim Hanna, calls that evolution.
20 years ago, it was a lot of protests. It was a real lack of engagement. I think what we've discovered, though, is that some of the strongest NGOs out there are the ones that choose to partner with corporations.
It's still an elaborate mating dance. But instead of stepping on each other's toes, this time in Rio, more NGOs and companies are doing the samba together. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a little corporate news and then some fun. Walgreens, the struggling drugstore chain, is going to look overseas for growth. It's going to spend almost $7 billion to buy about half of the European health and beauty retailer Alliance Boots. If you're thinking right now, that's great, but why does that matter to me? Here's one reason. Together, the pair will be the world's single biggest buyer of prescription drugs. Also, scientists at Boots are the ones who invented ibuprofen. You learn something new every day. All right, now just to cap off our listing of economic acronyms, we got this from Penelope on our Facebook page yesterday. Quote, is there a cutesy acronym for an old cheapskate working to be debt-free? I don't know. Maybe you guys can help me out. Here's the most personal, though. Amy, also on our Facebook page, said, I hate it that my sweet baby's name has become an acronym. We're going to guess that's Henry, right? Not sitcom or yuppie. If you've got your own acronym for today's economic times, you know where to find us. We're on Facebook or on Twitter. That's at Marketplace APM. Here's one last one on the way out.
I'm more like a Meppner, medium earner, probably never rich.
I'm a broke.
Today, the Dow added 95 points, 0.75%, finished at 12,837. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, 1.2%, 2929. The S&P 500 put on 13 points, nearly 1%, 1357 at the bell. Thanks to Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.